back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. And this week, we are an offshoot of Is It Yours? So, if you haven't listened to the Is It Yours episode that came out last week, which covered the TV movie Killdozer, you might want to put this show on hold, go back, listen to that, and then come back here and listen to this. Because today, we are going over the issue number 6 of Worlds Unknown, which was an adaptation of Killdozer. And as such, I have back with me the two people who I reviewed the movie with, and that would be Mr. Sean Whalen.
Pleasure to be
here.
Pleasure
to have you. And Mr. Tim Elliott.
Morning.
Morning. And if you people are listening, it is morning here. It may not be where you are listening, but right now it's morning, and where Tim is, it's really morning, because he's 3 hours earlier than me. The first thing that jumps out at me about this book, and we'll talk about the actual content in a minute, but the movie came out on February 9th of 1974. The book is cover dated April of 74, and apparently it was released on December 18th of 73. So that was the first thing as I started to look over it, because it appears to me that this is much more an adaptation of the novella than it is of the movie. And we do have the advantage of having Tim with us, who has read the novella, but we have the disadvantage of the fact that he read it probably 20 years ago and doesn't remember all the details. But, you know, we'll have to work with what we got, you know? So, did you guys have that same feeling that this is the prose, not the movie?
Yeah, especially with some of the places it went, it certainly felt that way. Now, I'm saying that not having read the prose, I actually want to read the prose after reading this. So if there's anything that I think it was successful on, and it got me even more interested in reading more of, like, where did this whole thing come from?
Yeah, well,
it does follow the book very closely. The only changes would be that the book fills in a little more of the characters, because you've got more time with them, and a little more time with them trying to keep away from the Killdozer.
Right. I'll say that my first experience with this, and I think we covered this last time, is seeing this comic book cover, which I just loved from day one. And that is drawn by Gil Kane. It's on the Marvel fan wiki, it lists as Gil Kane, Ernie Chan, John Romita, and Gaspar Saladino. Now, I think Gaspar Saladino is the letterer, and I guess Ernie Chan and John Romita both did some inking on it. It was probably drawn by Gil Kane, inked by Ernie Chan, and then touched up by John Romita, is my guess. Because John Romita, I believe at this time, was the, you know, was Marvel's
art director.
Yeah. So that's my guess. But this to me is just a great cover. It's very entrancing to me. And it's got basically the bulldozer's got, you know, a jagged edge on its what would you even call that piece?
Blade?
Yeah, I guess, yeah. I guess it's a blade. Its headlights are made out to be like evil-looking eyes, and the grill almost looks like a mouth. And it's actually speaking, which is not something that occurs in the novel, from what I understand, or this comic, or the movie. But it says, you dared defy me, and so you must die. And it's got a guy who's being crushed, or two guys being crushed underneath it. There's another guy who's shooting a gun at it while he's apparently trying to help a girl run away. And at least in the movie, there is never a girl. So, you know, this is not a scene that we got in the movie. This really isn't a scene we got in the book or the comic. But it's just, like I said, to me, it's entrancing. And it just captures my imagination. And I just love this cover.
The movie used the lights as eyes. I mean, it was really, it was very apparent that it was trying to do that. So it's really, if there's one thing that was taken out of this, I don't know if it was taken from this cover, but if there's at least reminiscent and connecting of the two, it was that that visual. And it's this cover is striking.
Yeah, this is one
almost a little violent for a comic code, comic code approved book.
Yeah,
I agree. It makes me grab it off the shelf.
I would agree, and it's I guess when I was, what did I say? It came out in 73, so I would have been 11. December of 73, I would have been just 11, so I would have been all over this. That violence would have entranced me even more than the cover did. And there's a lot of like good detail in here too. You could see the motion lines for the gear shift. There's also like a little smokestack in the back where you could see there's, you know, some black smoke coming out of it. So, you know, there's a lot going on here. And again, it's just, I if I remember right, I really liked this. I thought it was so cool, and my brother made fun of me for it. That's just my memory. I could be wrong. If I asked him about it, he would have no memory, I guarantee.
Well, I will say Gil Kane has never seen an actual bulldozer, because the design of this not physically possible the way that it's that way in the book too. The way they've got the blade arm is almost an articulated arm instead of just an up and down motion.
Yeah,
makes for a cool cover.
Yeah, and that's all I care about, because I'm trying to think if I ever saw a bulldozer. I mean, I've seen movies, I've seen pictures. I don't know if I've ever been physically in the presence of a bulldozer. And after seeing this movie and reading this book, I don't know that I want to be.
I do.
So the story, unlike the movie, again, opens up, and I guess it's taking place on Earth like billions of years ago. And I just right off the bat, I find this fascinating, because what the story is setting forth is that whatever population, if you want to say men or whatever, had advanced like, you know, really far with their science and their technology. And ended up in some sort of war against the robots kind of thing, you know, kind of a Terminator kind of thing, which resulted in basically Earth's decimation and one, I guess, spirit or intelligence or whatever that somehow survived it and got buried in on an island. So just the concept that man had progressed that far and then had to start all over again from scratch is just that's something I hadn't really ever thought about, because I always just think about, you know, man starting and, you know, building up over time. But to think like it started and it's a cycle that started all over again is a pretty cool concept right off the bat. What do you guys think?
I like that it was different than the film. I mean, in a strange way, because I liked the movie quite a bit. It was fun reading the adaptation and seeing this version of it, because not having read the novel. The idea, you know, within the film, you've got this, it's coming from outer space. And so clearly this is an alien entity. This one, I found myself during the comic having to remind myself, wait a minute, no, this was already here. This is some form of mutation that was created by this really advanced society that died out. It was a cool concept, very heady, because I think it's something that's very rarely explored. What if there was something that came before that was this kind of advanced, you know, in history? And I thought it was just a really different concept. I was engaged by it. I thought that was a neat part of the comic. And there is no time for this to appear on TV, I think, in the way that it would need to be done. But I would have loved to have seen it, just because it's something I just think really different in sci-fi. It's, you know, I don't think you get to see a lot of this.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I recall the book, they go a little more detail about this. They're like energy or electrical creatures that take over the humans' robots. So that sets the ground rules that they can take over machines. Miles is later when it takes over the Killdozer. And you get a little more, I think, of the backstory, I think, in the book, a little more page of that. And it's kind of the lost Atlantis kind of story, you know, that, you know, civilization was around and everything went into ruin, and then we had to start all over again.
I always thought, and I'm sure I might, you know, because I've never read anything on Atlantis except for, you know, Namor. So, you know, the real, I guess, theories and concepts and all of that I've never delved into. But I was always under the impression that there was kind of a parallel advancement, and that part of society died off, as opposed to that society existing, dying off, and then it's starting all over again, as it's doing here. So, you know, that could just be my own lack of knowledge there. But because I didn't have that concept in my mind, this came off, to use Sean's words, as very heady to me. You know, I hadn't really ever considered that. And there, so much time had passed, plus, you know, the Earth was decimated by this conflict, that there would be no ruins or things for people to find to say, oh, look, there had been a society, you know, before us. Unless, of course, like Easter Island or something was... you know, was from this society. And then they throw another interesting thing in here. And again, I don't know what's Jerry Conway and what's Theodore Sturgeon. But that this particular energy that does survive was mutated somehow. And it would have actually been vulnerable to the way the people originally attacked. And they could have destroyed it. But it had basically been hidden or something. So it got by until they went for the other method of destruction, and that it was able to survive. So it's kind of, again, very heady.
It's high concept for sure. I think that was a lot of Sturgeon's. I haven't read any of his other work, but I think that's a lot of his kind of high concept sci-fi.
It's breathtaking, too. I mean, just the vast displays that we're seeing in front of us on these pages. It really is beautiful artwork. It's funny. Nice.
Yeah, I don't think I mentioned that the interior art is by Dick Ayers and inked by Ernie Chua. And Dick Ayers, I seem to have more familiarity, unless I'm mistaken, with him from like Westerns and War, you know, like Sergeant Fury and stuff like that. I don't really have any recollection or any frame of reference that I can go to off the top of my head of him doing superhero work, but he may have done some Iron Man or something at some point, but I can't put my finger on anything at the moment.
He did, I had to do a little research on him because I knew his name as an inker, and I know he was, he inked a lot of Kirby in the 60s, but he wasn't known for his own work outside of, he did like Rawhide Kid, he did Sergeant Fury and Howling Commandos, and he did mostly Westerns and war stuff.
Right.
Maybe that was his thing. He didn't like to do the superhero stuff until, I think, in the 70s, he started doing his own work. But his art style, I can really recognize it. And it looks like it kind of changes depending on who his anchor is. Because if you look at the stuff that was on Sergeant Fury that's John Severin, it has a more of a cartoony style. And then when he was did a couple issues of the Hulk, and I don't remember who, it was not Severin who inked that, but it looked like he was aping whoever would come before him. So his stuff looked like Trimpy when he did the Hulk. His stuff looked like Kirby early on when he was doing Sergeant Fury, and then he kind of morphed into his own style.
Well, I see a little bit of the facial drawings in this one that make me think a little bit of Romita. And that may, again, be a reflection of either the fact that Romita was the art director, or maybe he even touched up a couple of the faces. But I do think...
I see a bit of a Gil Kane influence, too.
Yeah.
A little bit in some of the faces. A lot of up-the-nose shots.
And I you know, you mentioned doing books with John Severin, and I happen to just love John Severin's work. And the funny thing is, I love John Severin's work, and I love Marie Severin's work, and I can't really tell the difference between them as far as style.
Oh, they look very, very, yeah. I like her more. I think I'm more familiar with her than him.
I would say I am as well. But again, when I look at his work, I was definitely familiar with her beforehand. So when I saw his stuff, it made me think of her. you know, and it's, you know, the similarity is very clear. So the story picks up now from, you know, whatever it is, billions of years later, where the men are being dropped off on the island to clear it so that they can build, you know, the what you call it, the blacktop people can come and build a landing strip. And right off the bat, there's some arguments between the and friction between the crew. And some of the dialogue, I got to say, and I don't know if it's taken from the novel or if it's coming straight from Jerry Conway's mind, but some of the dialogue feels a little clunky to me. It does not feel like something people would actually say.
And agree there. I mean, some of it seems more inner thought type dialogue, but they're saying it out loud.
It's a little bit of a little bit of inner thought, a little bit of exposition, and a little bit of move the plot along. And I totally get the move the plot along stuff because, you know, you only have so many pages to get this story told.
Which you have to establish pretty quickly, and it does work. The only part that does work, I actually totally agree on the dialogue choices, but this idea that this is a crew, which is pretty common, where there's somebody with ambition, or there's somebody that, like, maybe hasn't even taken the necessarily steps to be in charge, but wants to be in charge. And is critical of everything that the person in charge does, looks for any opportunity for that person to slip up, for them to slip in. I felt like the crew themselves, it felt real, aside from the dialogue piece, because I agree with you. I'm like sitting here, I'm like, boy, man, there's some interesting dialogue choices here that are kind of throwing me off a little bit. But as far as it's in spite of that, and I think this is where the artwork is continuing to succeed, the setting up of the atmosphere of what this crew and their relationship is like is pretty critical, because it's something I really liked about the movie. And I like here, even though we're dealing with some different characters in this particular presentation, this idea that it's a crew where these aren't guys that like sit around the campfire at night swapping stories and liking each other's company. These are guys that break off into little crews, little cliques. And there's probably one or two of them that like go between all of them to try and keep good relationships. It's not a healthy camp. Mm. And I really liked that like is stuff that's to your point, as far as cooking, I know everything I need to know in order to go forward from just write this introductory piece. Let's just go now and like start killing people. which is kind of interesting. The story goes
right on this first page of them being on the island. The last shot to me is very effective because of the angle choice of it. The way it appears to me is, you know, it looks like this bulldozer is going up at a very steep angle. So it's, and it's, you know, there's not really motion lines, but there's enough going on with the dirt being pushed and the smoke coming out of it, that it really gives the impression for me that just from this image of how powerful this particular machine is.
And we should say that the big difference is this is a D7 because of when the story was written in the 40s, as opposed to a D9, which is what they had in the 70s. So this is a smaller caterpillar.
Yeah, but to be fair, most people wouldn't know the difference. You know, that's a technical point, and you're absolutely correct. But I don't know the fact that they called it a D7 as opposed to the movie calling it a D9 would create any kind of understanding in anyone who doesn't have construction knowledge. Yeah. Again, like I said, I'm not even 100% sure I've ever been in close proximity to a bulldozer. Now, the next page where go ahead.
Again. Quick, this is a weird aside, and it's a question for both of you, actually. So, I mean, I was like 2 when this came out, but as is very common, I got a lot of comics from flea markets, things like that growing up. I read stuff well before this. I love, you know, the wealth of comics. It was interesting on this page. This has this little blurb about the Torch and Medusa alone together against the sinister snow monster with an advertisement for Fantastic Four. I don't remember that a lot. I read a lot of Marvel comics. And I mean, is this something I just am obvious that I've missed? Or are these kind of little blurbs thing that was happening quite a bit? And if it is, I'm glad to know that I was oblivious, but I read my stuff over and over again. I don't remember a lot of
it. Yeah, back in this era, that they did that a lot, where you'd have the little things at the bottom advertising other comics coming out. And I know though that particular issue really well, because that's when I first started reading the Fantastic Four. but yeah, that was I thought it was a clever way of advertising, to just throw stuff in at the bottom like that. And if you read it, you read it. If you didn't, you know, it'd be real easy to overlook it.
I do too. I saw it in this one. I'm kind of like, wow, I don't remember a lot of them. I don't know when it stopped or. But I just thought it was cool. So I didn't mean to do weird aside there. It was just kind of something I happened to notice in the issue that I thought was just intriguing. I'm like, what an interesting advertising placement.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It was effective. It caught my eye. I want to seek out that Fantastic Four issue just because of the fact that the blurb was catchy.
Yeah, well, it was a very atypical Fantastic Four issue. Actually, it was two issues, that particular story. And again, that's when I first started buying Fantastic Four. My familiarity with them at that time was purely from the cartoon that had previously been out. I say go ahead, buy those issues. I think I appeared on the Fantastic Cast when they did one of those, because I had mentioned that it was when I started. And that is, we'll move on from that aside for now. The next page, I think, does a good job of just, in the artwork again, working with the artwork, of just showing kind of the tension between some people and the atmosphere that they're working in, the choices, the close-ups, the angles, the shading. I just can't speak highly enough of the way the artwork works in this book. I'm really enjoying it.
The way he draws Tom, who's the foreman, draws him kind of shouty a lot. He seems to be barking orders a lot. And this is the page you point out, Paul, that you get a little bit of tension with him and Dennis, who, and I don't remember this from the book, but in this. I can't tell if they're hinting that he is being racist towards. He tells the Rivera, hops on the bulldozer to go up and start clearing off the top of this hill, or if he just thinks he's not ready because he's a mechanic and he should be running the equipment. But anyway, there's obviously tension there, and Tom kind of takes up for Rivera by telling him basically, you know, shut your mouth. And then he has a little conversation with Peebles, which is a mechanic, and he kind of says the same thing. You know, he shouldn't be riding that, using the bulldozer, because he's a mechanic. Like that builds that tension right from the get-go.
And now, just again, focusing a little on the artwork, the way Tom is drawn, the hair is very different. But other than the hair, the facial expression, the eyes, look to me like Lee Marvin. I don't know if that was an influence on airs as he was drawing the character or not, but you know, just something that I saw, whether it's real or not, you know, or just my own interpretation, I don't know.
I could see Lee Marvin there.
So then the bulldozer continues, and it goes to now this goes against kind of what I said, because there's almost like an Aztec looking temple that he runs into. So that goes against my thought that there are no ruins, there is no prior stuff. And he just rams right into it, which you would think that would be not the most advisable action. And that's what frees this spirit to then take over the bulldozer, which promptly kills Rivera. And we don't... The dialogue kind of changes as it goes along, because when this first happens, Tom yells, "It killed Rivera, and now it's after me." So it's as if he immediately gave it, you know, a consciousness that it knows what it's doing. But then the dialogue after that kind of resets it, that he starts thinking, and you know, excuse me, it's not dialogue. His thought balloons start and well, combination of thought balloons and dialogue boxes, that, you know, that it's, he's thinking something went loose and something is wrong with it and that he can somehow fix it. And then he pulls the transmission wires from it, which then, it doesn't look like it, well, I guess it totally stopped it at that point, because he gets thrown off, and then when he's on the ground, you see, or when they're looking at Rivera, rather, you see the bulldozer in the background stationary.
We've also got this great scene where, like, it's never happened on any construction site ever, where Tom is, like, rallying him to knock down the Aztec temple and yelling, go, go!
Yeah.
I love that panel.
I don't think, like, who's doing that on any construction site anywhere? And I didn't take away from my enjoyment of this at all, but it goes back to what you were saying very earlier on. There's some dialogue choices in this that are just, really? That's what you decided to go in?
And it's...
Well, they kind of...
Go ahead.
Sorry, Paul, go ahead.
Well,
so they set up early that, I think Chubb, one of the guys, says, how do you like being the guinea pig? You know, it's just seven of us alone on this island for 3 weeks. And he goes, yeah, but no bosses, no time clocks. All we got to do is just get the job done. So he's kind of in a hurry to, they need this temple torn down and went to stone to build landing runway, which they don't make it clear in the comic, but in the book, they're building a landing strip for World War II base or something. They're in the Pacific. They don't make it clear here. They are if that's the time frame or not.
And I would imagine, you know, breaking this down a little bit, that this is done in the traditional Marvel method. So I'm thinking that the artwork was done, and this was handed to Jerry Conway, who, if my recollection is correct, was probably south of 20 at this point. You know, he started very young writing comics. Not quite Jim Shooter young, but young. So I'm thinking he's handed this. He's probably handed the novella and said, you know, dialogue this. So there's probably some choices here that go with the novellas, probably some choices that are a little different than the novella, and it's up to him to kind of dialogue it in a way that it makes sense. So I think, you know, there were some conflicting ways of attacking this thing. But then on top of that, I think that, you know, again, he's relatively young and inexperienced at this point. He was writing Spider-Man and you know, had already done the death of Gwen Stacy. So it's not as if he didn't have any chops. He did. But I think this may have been, I think an older Jerry Conway would have dialogued this better.
The narrative balloons and things like that are going along. And I like the story quite a bit. I'm not like anti the story. There's just some dialogue choices that are just a little off. But I just say that I love the story. I mean, it was just a lot of fun to read. But one of the choices that they made in this that I'd be remiss if I didn't mention it right now because it stood out for me on this. We got to see the movie before this where they were using clearly the eyes as kind of a visual of this thing is kind of alive. It's got some human qualities or some, you know, living qualities. I actually appreciate that the comic didn't do that. Like, it pretty much is just a bulldozer. And I actually really liked the choice. It, for some reason, added more of a creep factor to me with the fact that it wasn't this cartoony over-the-top thing. Like, I love the cover. Don't get me wrong. I'm not knocking the cover. But we all know the cover is kind of to draw you into the book, and then you get to the real story.
Right.
In the real story, there actually isn't this personification of this bulldozer. And I actually thought it was much more effective, the fact that it's creepier that, like, to your point, Paul, like, I don't be a little careful standing around bulldozers these days after I've seen with Killdozer. And this in particular, I think, does a really effective job of the artwork is very realistic and grounded overall in what it's doing. And it adds a creep factor to it. Like I'm really, like Paul just put up behind himself right now, an image of a bulldozer. I'm worried for him.
Coming up behind you.
Ah.
But I thought the artwork is really solid on this, and it added, I think it added a really cool creep factor to
this.
Yeah,
no, I, I, I have to say, you know, the more we go through it, and I don't think this would have stood out to me if I was just reading the story for fun. But when we read it to dissect it, the artwork carries this book through. I don't think there's any question in my mind. And I don't even think that's being unfair to Jerry Conway, because he's handed a story that's, you know, pre-written for him, and he's just asked to dialogue it, and he's given artwork, and it's like, you know, come up with something. So, you know, at this point in the story, again, they're you know, talking about the bulldozer, and that it's, you know, the one guy saying that he you know, that after he got out of it, it was bucking like a bronc, revving like a bronc, and me and Kelly had to go up there and shut it down before the engine froze up. At which Tom is now realizing something's going on, because he says, that's impossible. I tore the transmission out, and she was dead. So, you know, we're now at the point where we know something is wrong.
Well, that's the big difference between this and the film, is that Clint Walker immediately is the one that is hesitant to believe anything's going on. He just thinks it's a malfunction. And this one, Tom thinks that there's something wrong with it, because when he hears that it was still revving, and he tore out the artwork, it looks like he's taken out the distributor.
Yeah.
But he calls it the transmission wires, whatever those are. And he's thrown off. And then I can't tell if that upper panel, if it's buttering to a stop, it looks like it's leaving, kind of laying on the ground and grabbing his hand.
But then when they're looking over Rivera laying on the ground, and you see Rivera's boot on the floor,
it stops.
You could see, unless that's a different bulldozer in the background.
I don't know. It could be. They said they were trying to get the other equipment up there. So maybe that was Dennis. And we get a little more of his attitude towards Rivera by saying, little fool deserved getting killed, because he thought he was probably riding it like a toy.
Yeah, that's enough to deserve to get killed.
Yeah. And that's when Tom gets in the face and grabs the one and tells him, yeah, it was revving up. And he's like, no, I killed it. You know, I turned it off, whatever. And everybody kind of start turning on him pretty quick. Yeah, no, you're crazy. You know, you just don't know what you're doing.
And it sort of is. It's actually one of the things that I liked about this is that there was no witnesses. You know, there was no survivor, there was no witnesses. This version of it, I really like that, as far as painting a picture that Tom might be the guy. I mean, we know what happened, which I quite like. I found the story, this one, under people, even those closest who were like more devil's advocate in his favor, they gradually turn against him. And I kind of get why. I mean, there's no, like, the story that he's coming back with is pretty ridiculous. Right. We know it's true. But I like that. Like, you're out of your mind. What are you doing? This dude's killing people.
Well, I think that's one of the.
Seems to be getting in his way.
I think that's one of the staples of a good horror movie or a good horror story, is one person kind of realizes what's going on and everybody else thinks he's crazy.
Yeah.
So he goes over. I guess the only mechanic that's left is Peebles. Is his name? And he goes to connect some burned out cables, and then she'll be as good as new. And the cables burn out Peebles. So then we have two graves right next to each other. Now, in the movie, the dozer destroys the radio so that they are effectively cut off. That didn't happen in here, and we have two dead people. You would think at some point they'd be contacting mainland.
They don't even mention that. There's not even dialogue about they need to contact for help or get the ship back or whatever. They almost like they don't have a radio.
Yeah. So then, you know,
That was a great choice of the film. I think just this, the isolationism that it created in the film, I thought that was really, really effective. You know, just this idea of, like, this is now Survivor. You're going to try to, you know, survive this experience because you got no way to get out.
That was Robert Shaw destroying the radio on the Orca in Jaws. So now they're debating what's going on and who should do what and how they're going to do everything. And then we have the letters page, which has the bane of my existence, the Marvel value stamp. Because occasionally I find a book that I'd like to buy, and then I see, you know, from honest sellers that it'll have a note on the, you know, on the bag saying no Marvel value stamp. And that just irks me to no end. I mean, I know that was the purpose and that's what you were supposed to do if you were collecting, but it just bothers the heck out of me. And then we have an ad for...
What were those stamps used for? Could you trade them in for something?
They had a book that you'd fill them all in, and I don't know if you could trade them in or if it was just to collect them all.
Like green stamps?
I'm pretty sure it was just to collect them, though. I don't think they had any intrinsic value beyond, ooh, yes, I got them all.
Well, this is still a time when books were disposable. They were meant to be read once, trade them, get rid of them, throw them away.
Yeah, and then we have, and I used to love this too. The next page we have Stan's soapbox, and then there's the bullpen, bulletin items, and then the Mighty Marvel checklist of what was coming out that month, which again I used to really enjoy that. And then we have an ad for I'm sick and tired of my job. Who isn't? And then we continue with the story, and they're still arguing about what to do.
Well, this is the point of the story where they actually accuse Tom of the murders. They say he killed Rivera with the bulldozer and then killed Peebles when he found out that he killed him. So they're straight up saying something wrong with you. You're sick or you're deranged or whatever. But they don't do any really actions to strain him at this point. They're just basically saying, yeah, we think he killed him.
Yeah,
I'm going to go along with you anyway.
Dialogues. Tom Jager is going to kill Dennis. He's gone after him like a madman, screaming and shouting, talking about what happened to Rivera, what's happening to him. You got to stop him. Jager's out for blood. At which point, they see the bulldozer tracks, and we see the fear in their eyes. And they see, I guess that's Dennis has been killed by the bulldozer, and we don't actually see what they see, but they're terrified.
Well, I love the caption box that says they find him, all 12 square feet of him, mashed up with a torn up patch of earth. And one panel looks like Tom is about to throw up. The other two guys are absolutely horrified, Chubb and Al. I think the bald guy is Al. A little more about him in the book, I know, because he's the one that kind of snaps and tries to help the bulldozer, trying to start feeding victims to it.
So then Chubb starts saying, you know, answer me, Tom. Tell me why you did it. And he said, why did I do what? So Tom is, like, I guess, ignorant of the fact that they think he killed these people. So why you killed him, ran him down with the D7 and you dumped the dozer in the sea. I did all that in the time it took you to come down to the beach. Why don't you face it, Chubb? It's that dozer. It's turned into some sort of monster. It's going crazy, Chubb, and it's trying to kill us all. He says, you know I can't buy that, Jagger. It's Chubb, nuts.
Well, he's enjoying a nice cup of coffee while this is
going on. Yeah, which actually doesn't plead his case anymore. It's like sitting here like, I'm calm. I'm like, you guys should be like worried about this bulldozer like I am. It was great.
But the story progresses naturally here because it goes to what makes sense. And I really appreciate that when you get a horror story. You know, when people automatically just accept the fantastic, it just doesn't seem right to me. Like I said, initially in that first couple of pages when Tom was saying, it's after me. He said it too quickly, but then in the next page, they kind of made it up when, you know, made up for it when he, you know, his dialogue and thought bubbles were, you know, kind of said that he just thought it was kind of a malfunction of some sort. So anyway, the guys start fighting and they knock Tom out. But then once that happens, the bulldozer comes to life and starts coming after them. And it's just, sweet Lord in heaven, it's true.
I noticed that Ayers draws, when he's drawing this, the bulldozer, he draws it kind of blade first, always. That blade is the most prominent piece of the artwork. Maybe that was because it was easier to draw that, because it's just a big rectangle, and you didn't have to draw the intricate machinery behind it. But that is most, that's what's coming at you all the time.
Yeah, I think that's the most imposing thing, though. I think either that
that's what's gonna
or the
kill
tire
you.
Treads. One of those two things are the thing that you got to be, you know, really frightened of, because those are the things that are going to kill you. And then I don't think this character ever got a name.
Yeah, that's the guy with the hard hat.
Red shirt number 3.
Yeah, I guess so. But it's just, you know, like
Kelly. I think that's Kelly. Okay.
Oh, you're right. You're right. No, he's right. It is Kelly. Okay.
Which is interesting how they changed up all the names in the film, you know, because Kelly's the head guy in the TV.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, but the, you know, the narration boxes, like some rampaging mammoth, the D7 plows downward. And almost as though it could think and judge, it seems to pick a target and bears down on it, death gleaming from its headlamp eyes. So the narration is telling us to anthropomorphize the eyes. And at this point, I guess now believing what's going on, Chubb picks up Tom and is running with him on his back.
Kelly is killed with a loud sprack. It looks like either the blade has come down on him or he's being run over by treads.
Yeah, and that's a good way of kind of portraying the horror without showing the bloodiness. Right. You know, the panel cuts off where you see his one arm and the other just kind of his fingers, you know, in the air as he's being run over, crushed, whatever it is that's going on to him. But you can, you know, you can feel the horror there.
Yep.
So now Tom and Chubb have to figure out what to do as the bulldozer. Now, I guess, you know, it's almost like the bulldozer knows, okay, now they know the jig is up. They know I have consciousness, so I'm going to destroy their camp and I'm just going to run around wantonly. Now what's?
I smile at the name Daisy Edda. Every time I see it, You know what it's reoccurring. Just the idea, the personification that they've given this thing because of you know, the Spanish. It still makes me smile. Even though I know it's a reoccurring thing and I'm being a little redundant with that, but when I was looking at it, I'm like, it's kind of it's something you do, right? Especially now that it's trying to kill you.
I think that's played up a little more in the book too. The fact that they've given it this nickname of Yeta, because, like you said, the Spanish pronunciation for D7.
Right.
That's used throughout the book, I think.
So now the character of Al is actually trying to reason with it. Daisy, let me help you. I'll fix you when you break down. I'll help you kill those other guys, because I know who's boss hereabouts, and it's you, Daisy. I'll help you. Just don't kill me. So he's already a conspirer. But it's still coming at him, but it doesn't run him down. So I guess, who knows, maybe it's accepting his offer. So now it starts going after Tom, and he says, got to draw that thing down to the beach, into the water, which he then races into the water. It follows him. Now, I don't understand all the logic of this. I'm not an electrician. I don't work with my hands for a living. But he's got some sort of a ground wire, and he connects it. How he gets the thing to slow down enough for him to connect it is beyond me. And then Chubb turns on a generator, which electrocutes it. But Tom is in the water when this is happening, and I know water conducts electricity, so I'm not really quite sure of the logistics of how this works. Do either of you have any kind of feel for this?
Go ahead, Sean.
I actually thought that was my whole big problem with the whole thing. The whole point of getting it in the water was the fact that it conducts electricity. You know, that was the whole idea here. Let's get it in here and we'll maximize the effect of this whole thing. and how he was still in the water. And you actually see what looks like at least the effect. He's in it. I mean, when you take a look at like the area that it's encompassing, you can actually see him. He looks like he's at least in the wave of that. How he's still alive, I don't know. It was puzzling to me.
Yes.
Yeah, it didn't make sense because he kept saying he had to. It's his hypothesis that because when Peebles was killed and he was going to use the arc welder on the bulldozer, he said it pulled an electrical arc across 50 feet and then jerked back itself another 20. Seems to me, I mean, she's afraid of that welder. And it had hinted at the beginning of the story that this last energy being was a mutant and it was susceptible to the weapons that the humans were using on it, which is maybe some kind of weapon. But then later he says, we got to find a way to get that Seven in the water, then ground her and run an arc through her. So again, it doesn't make sense. If why does she need to be in the water? If she's on the Earth, isn't she grounded? And if you plug something into her and run electricity through her? I don't know. I can't remember how it ends in the book. I know it does. They do get her in the ocean and electrocute her somehow, but I don't know if somebody actually plugs in whatever he's plugging into her to ground her. So,
yeah, it just
doesn't make a lot of sense. And how he survives, I don't know.
Yeah, that to me, that was the biggest problem was that he was able to connect this ground with, you know, in one panel, because it should have been a much more difficult task than that. And then that he's in the water when this is going, which you got to think the whole reason to do this in the water is because it conducts electricity. Although I could have accepted that we have to get it in the water because the water, it's going to slow it down and not, you know, it's not going to be able to get away from us before we can charge it. But like Sean said, the image of the, I guess, explosion or whatever you want to call it, encompasses where Tom is, so you would think it would kill him as well. But then, you know, then it's over, and the stink of ozone has faded slightly in the air, and the two of them say, you know, guess we better keep quiet about what really happened here, Chubb. Tell them others died when those ruins exploded, and some of the tractors went wild. What about Al? He'll talk, and then they show Al, and he's so, like, basically insane looking that they're not going to believe him. And that's how the story ends. And I could understand why you wouldn't want to tell what really happened, because people won't believe you. And they'll just assume you killed these people. But on the other hand, he says some of the tractors went wild. It's like his story is encompassing the lie and the truth. The lie is they died when the explosion happened, but then we're going to say the tractors went wild. Why are you going to say the tractors went wild?
I think this is before OSHA, so I don't think he can just say, well, it was a, you know, mishap, malfunction.
See, I think you can get away with the lie of they got killed when there was an explosion in the ruins. And then you probably just have to answer, you found ruins and you just destroyed them anyway. But that's besides the point. How are you explaining that there's a overloaded electrical charge to a bulldozer that's in the water, probably a very good distance from those ruins?
But you should have seen how cool it looked when we destroyed the ruins. I was hoorah. It was great.
So
I think Tom says early in the story that he knew about the ruins. Those must be the, like maybe when they did a flyover or whatever they planned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just seems crazy that they would just destroy ruins like that. But, you know, whatever. It happens, I guess.
I mean, they're not even taking account continental drift. I mean, this is a billion years. I doubt that island would still be in the same location or configuration. I don't think the ruins would last, but that has to happen to be for the story to work.
What's a billion years among friends? Right. So, I love the artwork in this story. I enjoy the story. My biggest problem with it is some of the dialogue is clunky and doesn't always make sense. What do you...
I think some of that, because they do have to, they've got, you know, 20 pages to tell the story, and they've got to move it along.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that.
This was a couple issues.
I'm even okay with that, and I can use that to explain, okay, that gives some excuse to the fact that the dialogue is clunky. It doesn't excuse the fact that some of it doesn't make sense. But, you know...
It reads like a cheesy horror movie.
Yeah.
Which a lot of cheesy horror movies don't make sense.
That's true.
I'm not excusing that, by the way. I'm just more throwing... I mean, on that level, it worked for me as a cheesy horror movie. I'm not excusing that, though. I like when things make sense. To me, my favorite horror movies are the ones, and there were elements of this that were some cool moments of this. That's neat what they're trying to do here, of keeping as much as you can in a comic book, a realistic bulldozer. You know, I mean, they didn't go super crazy on personifying it. I'm like, that was kind of neat. I kind of liked that part, that stayed as grounded as it possibly could, considering the situation. It was, I think, made some of the other pieces a little more annoying to me, because I think there was some little course correction. They could have taken out some of the parts that didn't, you know, could have adjusted some of the parts that made sense. But you're right, Tim, we've got an economics of time and pages to try and tell, to move along a story and get us there. I think we all kind of were talking about that in the beginning, just how quickly things jumped in the beginning. You know, like, we're a crew, here we are, we're here, this is what our dynamic is, let's move.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. They did have to do that, unless you're going to make this a two-issue story, and they weren't. And also the fact that, again, you know, knowing how they did things, the Marvel method, Conway was probably handed these pages and just said, dialogue it, go ahead. You know, I don't think it was, you know, he certainly didn't give a script with directions on what to put on each page. I guarantee you that didn't happen. So, you know, you could excuse some of it with that. And frankly, part of the charm of this story is the cheesiness. Like, if it took itself way too seriously, I think it would be less charming. And then the other thing is funny, because, you know, Sean, you made mention just now of the fact that they don't really personify the bulldozer within, and that's a strength of the story. And yet the strength of the cover to me is it totally personifies the bulldozer.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I love it.
So it's like a total conflict that doing it in one event gives it a strength, and then not doing it in the other also gives it a strength.
And the cover's outstanding. That's not a knock on the, I don't mean it as a knock on the cover, but it is, the cover is a sharp,
I gotta get you to grab that off the shelf.
Yeah.
And you would absolutely, this would make me grab it off the shelf.
So, to follow our back to the bins format, I'm going to rate this and then ask you guys for your ratings. I'm giving the cover, because I absolutely love this cover, I'm giving it an A+. I just love this. The interior art, I'm not quite at A+ with it, but it's really solid and I really like it. So I'm just giving it a regular A. The story, I'm going to give a B, but the dialogue, I'm going to give a C+. And overall, I'm going to rate this comic as a solid B.
Solid B?
Sorry?
A B?
I'm rating it as a B, yeah.
Okay, I heard B. No. It is an Edda.
You want to go ahead, Tim?
No, go ahead.
The cover, I can't agree with you more of it. It's an A+. It's an amazing cover, and I usually like the covers to like make sense. But back in this era, this was very common. You know, where you'd get that cover that was meant to draw you in, that was done like either ages before, or with limited understanding of what's inside. This cover is amazing. I really love that cover. It's poster worthy. The interior artwork is gorgeous. There's a few little pieces of it where story-wise it didn't make sense, and especially considering the Marvel method, you knew, like, you're handed this artwork. Hey, tell the story with this. It's like, oh, boy. With a couple of the choices that are in there. But it's gorgeous artwork. So I'm going to give the artwork an A, too. Both story and dialogue for me is a C. And that sounds like I'm knocking it. It's a horror cheesy horror story, and it works for me on that, and it made me smile. But it's that piece. I agree with the B, you know, being kind of the book thing on this. I'd recommend it to anybody to check it out because I think it's an interesting story, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Not trying to knock the writer or anything like that. I think he did the best that he could with what he was given and crafted a story that was a page turner for me. I'm glad I read this. I would have never read this otherwise. If we hadn't done Killdozer and all that, and not because of me being like some hoity toity thing, it's just, it wasn't on my radar. So I'm thrilled that I had the opportunity to do this with you guys because I got to read and watch something that, I had never seen before. And this was fun. This is a fun read. If you have not read this, you should read this.
I kind of wonder what if Conway, if this was an original story and Conway wasn't given the short story to have to adapt, would his dialogue have been a little more natural or organic because he wasn't having to work from his sword, whatever he wanted to about a killing folder?
Yeah, that's the thought.
It might have ditched the whole alien or ancient civilization part in the beginning. Backstory to explain, really. That's why I thought the TV movie did such a better job. Like, nope, we're just going to call it a meteor, and it's something from outer space. That's all you need.
Hmm. Yeah, but I guess, you know, like we said, I don't think Conway had a choice on that.
No. All right, I'm going to give a cover an A. I'm a sucker for Gil Kane, and I do love the fact that this would, if I was reading comics at the time, I would probably grab this off the show. Inside artwork, I'm also giving it an A. Because it's not as much as I like his artwork with Severin, but this is nice that it's not superhero fare. And it does, there's a lot of dynamic action scenes in here that are pretty cinematic, you know. Gonna use that kind of word back then. And I'm giving this story a a solid B because it is a good adaptation, although they had to truncate a little bit because of the amount of pages we had. And I didn't make the connection when I was reading it, but I agree that some of the dialogue is a little funky. I guess my overall would be about a B+. It's strong.
Right, cool. This was fun. Definitely fun to do both the movie and the comic. I enjoyed that. I guess that'll be it for this. So Tim, thanks for joining us, and Sean, thanks for joining us. I forget, you know, we do so many shows together on Is It Yours that I forget that this is not your show. But thanks for thanks to the two of you for doing this one with me.
Got a little bit of trivia on this, Paul, if I can.
Absolutely.
Give me 30 seconds more. Okay. This was Worlds Unknown, so it ran, I think, 8 issues, and it was adaptions of short stories. So there were other sci-fi short stories. There was no superheroes in it. And then the last 2 issues were, they switched to the Golden Voyage of Sinbad, which was, I think, the movie that was out at the time. And it got canceled. Well, they were going to follow it back up, bring it back with the original story called Cyborg. But it got canceled. Well, that Cyborg story became Deathlok in another story. What I'm thinking is, and it's I can't find any proof of this, is Martin Caden's novel Cyborg, what $6 Million Man is based on, came out in 72. If they were adopting novels or existing stories, and then the $6 Million Man had been out a year before this came out. So I wonder if that was what kind of inspired them to do Cyborg that then became Deathlok.
Very possible.
That was kind of high end.
That's a cool trivia bit, and thank you. And Deathlok ended up appearing in Astonishing Tales. So, all right, yeah, cool trivia. Thanks.
The only other thing I want to say is, Tim, your comments on this have made me want to seek out the doggone novella to this. I want to read, like, it's. I never thought I would like go this far down, Killdozer. But I actually do want to read the novella now.
I'm sure you could probably buy a digital copy of it on Amazon or something. I found mine in just a bookstore that was a collection of Peter Sturgeon stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure
it's easy to find. You can probably find it for free online.
I would bet you can. and I may or may not try and seek it out. I'm curious to seek it out, but there's a lot of things I'm curious to seek out that I never get around to, so we'll see if that happens. But once again, thank you guys for coming on and doing this with me. This was fun, and I hope people enjoyed listening to us.
A lot of fun.
Everybody, we'll see you next week with some kind of show. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.